Inside Florida Politics. The Essential Podcast, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, coming to you from our studio in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm joined, as always, from Tallahassee by Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy.
Hello, George.
And by Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor, Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
All right, fellas, we have a, you never know how a podcast is going to turn out, but I feel like this is going to be like when I make the coffee in the Palm Beach Post newsroom, robust. Let's get right to it. We have just a little bit of what we're going to be covering today. You know, what happens if Roger Stone gets indicted? Roger Stone is a South Florida man. What happens if he gets indicted? Well, we're going to hear what Roger Stone says about that. Also, you won't believe what happened when Republican Governor Rick Scott went to the Republican stronghold of Venice this week in Sarasota County. Zach Anderson was there and will give us an eyewitness account and some audio. And John Kennedy is going to break down the dueling education proposals that were rolled out on the same day this week by Democrat Andrew Gillum and Republican Ron DeSantis in the governor's race. And then also, you know, remember, we've talked on the podcast about how spectacularly wrong all those polls were before the primaries last month. Well, now many of those same pollsters are putting out new numbers on the general election for governor and U.S. Senate in Florida. I guess we'll talk about, you know, should we believe those numbers, or how should we look at those numbers? That's all coming up. Well, first, though, as promised, Roger Stone was a longtime friend of President Donald Trump. Probably the guy that first persuaded him to run for president. He's been encouraging him to do that since back in the 1980s. Roger Stone was in West Palm Beach talking to a crowd of 400 or 500 Trump supporters, and he addressed the Mueller probe and the toll he said it's taking on him, and what would happen if he gets indicted. Here's what Roger Stone had to say.
This threatens to bankrupt my family. They have systematically attempted to ruin my business, and they seem to be following the MSNBC narrative. Well, I'm ready. I will never roll on Donald Trump.
There you have it. He will never roll on Donald Trump. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, I think, some kind of music playing. Podcast listeners know that funky royalty-free music means it's time for our pick a number segment. That's where each of us puts forward a number, and then later in the podcast, we explain what that number means in Florida politics. I hope each of you gentlemen has brought a number. Why don't we start with you, John Kennedy? What have you brought a number today, and what is it?
Yes, George, let me fish it out here. It's 378.
378 for John Kennedy, back in the high number territory. Okay. And this week, I'm going to try to, there's been some confusion on my part in the past, but I'm going to write it down. 378, John Kennedy. Okay. Zach Anderson, what number do you have?
Going much, much lower than that, George. I'm going with an 18 today. 2018 midterm, going with an 18.
18 for Zach Anderson. And my number is 32.2. I like getting a decimal point in there. It gives the feeling of exactitude. And as always, we encourage podcast listeners to take notes as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. So if you are taking notes, John Kennedy has a 378, Zach Anderson, 18, and George Bennett, that's me, my number is 32.2. So you're going to want to hang on, and near the end of the podcast, we will explain what those numbers mean in Florida politics. But let's get back to this Roger Stone thing. just to set the table for you, around the state, President Trump's supporters around Florida have formed these, they're basically fan clubs for Donald Trump. And they meet, the one in West Palm Beach. And the idea is it's kind of like a parallel to the Republican Party, but a lot of Trump supporters think the Republican Party is too wishy-washy. And the one in West Palm Beach regularly draws several hundred people to its meetings. Ron DeSantis spoke to them. Other elected officials have come. And they have these meetings and just kind of keep the Trump base enthused about the 2018 elections. At least that's the plan. And so this past week, Roger Stone came and spoke to the group and, addressed a number of topics. His advice for the 2018 midterms, he said the midterms are going to be challenging. He thinks that President Trump needs to do an Oval Office address, taking credit for peace and prosperity. And then also laying out why he thinks the Mueller investigation is corrupt. That's Roger Stone's idea for strategy for the 2018 midterms. But then Roger Stone, by his own account, said that 12 of his associates have been interviewed by the Mueller team and 8 of them have been before the grand jury. So it certainly heightens the speculation that Stone is some kind of target in the investigation, most likely over his contact with WikiLeaks back in 2016, which he has said was entirely benign or didn't amount to collusion or getting any advance information that wasn't public. He said the investigation has cost him more than $2 million and he has a legal defense fund, which he promoted at the meeting, if anybody wanted to give him a contribution. And then came his declaration, though, that he'll never roll on Donald Trump. So if Roger Stone gets indicted, he is pledging that he will not testify or turn evidence against Donald Trump. And he made a similar declaration in Palm Beach County a month or so ago. He showed up at an event here and said this similar thing to me. And I said, well, when you say that, does that imply there is something that you have on Trump or that you would, there is something there to testify against? And he said, no, not that he knows of. But he said this, it's possible in his view that he'll be framed and that they'll try to get him to testify against Trump. And he said he's not going to do that. And that got big applause. The other thing, though, that got the biggest applause of the night, and let's see what you guys think about this. probably the biggest applause Roger Stone got in the night was when he said that Bill and Hillary Clinton should be prosecuted. He didn't specify for what, but the crowd cheered very loudly and there were chants of lock her up, just kind of reminiscent of the 2016 election season. And if I recall, Zach Anderson, you were at an event where lock her up became a factor. What was chanted? Which event was that?
So this was a rally for a state house candidate, a GOP state house candidate back in February. There was a special election here in Sarasota that was really viewed as sort of a bellwether race. It was a state house district that Trump carried by more than 4 percentage points. But the Democrats put up a pretty strong candidate who raised a bunch of money. We got down to the wire and the Republican candidate brought in Corey Lewandowski to hold a rally on the weekend before voting. And Lewandowski was there and, he was talking about the 2016 campaign. And I think he mentioned Hillary Clinton and the crowd starts chanting, lock her up, which was kind of remarkable, more than a year after the 2016 campaign. This is still a huge rallying cry for Republicans. And it was just kind of amazing to see it in a state house race, especially. Didn't turn out too well for the Republican candidate. He ended up losing by more than 7 percentage points in a election that was really had national attention and was viewed as a strong sign for Democrats heading into the 2018 midterm.
Sure. And I guess the relevance of lock her up is it certainly riles up Trump supporters. And we have talked a lot about the midterms in Florida being a base election, which is instead of the emphasis isn't going to be so much on persuading these undecided voters in the middle as it is turning out the respective bases of each party. And so, so I guess the question is, lock her up and that kind of thing. Is the Trump base that turned out for him with so much enthusiasm in 2016, are those folks going to turn out in 2018 when Trump himself is not on the ballot?
It didn't work out, George, in this special election. You know, bringing in Corey Lewandowski was kind of viewed as a Hail Mary, that it was sort of like sending out the bat signal to all the Trump supporters that you better get out and get involved in this special election. You know, Trump might not be running, but, you know, his policies are still on the ballot here. And I think in some ways, some people thought that it just fired up the other side to come out. And the Republican ended up losing, like I said, by 7 points.
Right.
Well, you know, it's a similar parallel to the question of whether Obama could have brought out people back in his midterm elections as well, which he failed to do in Florida. But it does have that kind of Pavlovian effect, I guess, on that base, you know, where if you mention the name Clinton's, Republicans will react. I don't think we're going to see the statewide candidates, guys like Rick Scott or Ron DeSantis, really try to play that card very often. But at the same time, I think they welcome this sort of subterranean effort that's going around the state where you may have these Trump clubs where they rally people.
Right. We'll definitely have to see. Now, I can definitely say in Palm Beach County, actually in Palm Beach County, there's two Trump clubs. There's this one that I went to that regularly draws, as I said, 500 or more people. And then there's another Trump fan club that meets up in the northern part of the county. And there's actually been some rivalry between the two about kind of internal fighting, claiming that the other one is using Trump's name improperly and things like that.
And Sharks and Jets kind of situation.
They're all Trump supporters, but there's been a little bad blood between the two groups. But we'll have to see if the Trump base it will be energized. Certainly, if you were in that room, it certainly felt a lot like the 2016 Trump rallies. But we'll see if that's
500 or more people is a lot of people, George. I mean, you don't see that at a lot of political gatherings, even a lot of gatherings for these candidates. It just shows that the president still really is the one who is motivating GOP voters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of lock her up and speaking of kind of chance that you maybe hear too much, let's switch over to your experience, Zach, over in Venice this week. Now, Venice, that's your part of the state. Is that a pretty Republican kind of place, right?
Yeah, it is deep red. Southern Sarasota County is a lot of retirees, and it is, very, very Republican. There is, though, a decent amount of Democrats, and they're retired, and they have more time on their hands. And so you do see some activism down there around Democratic issues and things like that. But it is a very conservative area overall.
Right. So Rick Scott goes to, we talked about it being a base election. He goes to one of his kind of base places there. And we're going to play some audio here. Thomas Cordy, our sound engineer, is going to cue up some audio of what happened when Rick Scott went to Deep Red Venice, Florida this week.
Red Tide Rick has got to go.
All right. Zach, set the scene for us. What happened?
George, you and I have covered a lot of political events where there are protesters. It's a pretty common feature for campaign rallies and other events in modern politics. But usually they're sort of off to the side. Maybe there's a few dozen of them standing off in a corner somewhere. The protesters really took over this event. I mean, it was kind of remarkable to see. When I got there, I was like, oh my God, is this a rally for Rick Scott or is this a rally for somebody else? Because it was just amazing to see how many people were crowded around this restaurant. It was a public restaurant and they were spilling out into the side on the sidewalk and out into the streets all over, probably a few hundred people by my estimation, with signs and the chant that you heard. It was very loud, boisterous. The red tide issue is really affected people in a very visceral way down here. You know, this is Florida. People want to go to the beach. They want to, you know, relax and enjoy the water and the sand and the sunshine. And when you have dead fish coming up on the beach every day, it really hits people hard, and people are really upset about it. And so, you know, they came out to let they took their aggression out on the governor at this particular event. And they really swarmed this restaurant where he was supposed to show up and really kind of took over the event in a way. They were blocking the entrance to the restaurant, so the governor would have had to sort of run a gauntlet of protesters to get in. And so his security escort pulled up to the back door, and the governor actually entered through the back door. But it was so loud outside that it was kind of hard to hold an event inside the restaurant. They turned up the music really loud to sort of drown out the protesters outside.
What was the music?
I can't remember. I think it was kind of country music. But they cranked it up real loud. But that sort of meant that the governor, you know, wouldn't be able to give a speech to his supporters inside. And so he just sort of mingled, shook hands for a few minutes, signed, you know, some campaign signs, autographed some things. And then he was right out the back door in about, you know, less 10 minutes or so, maybe just kind of in and out. I think the whole protest scene sort of flustered him a little bit, and he went out the back door. His security detail actually pulled their SUV up onto the sidewalk to sort of block people from being able to get access to him. But I was out there in the back when the governor exited, and people kind of got wind that he was going to exit out the back door. So you had a few dozen protesters in the back who migrated to the back, and they were screaming, "Coward, coward," at him, and just that whole Red Tide Rick chant. And he kind of just quickly got into his SUV and he was off. And so it was a very brief event. He didn't speak to the media. He didn't give a speech to any of his supporters. And it was very sort of tumultuous and quick.
So now what was it an organized group that was putting on this protest?
Yeah, I think there was definitely some organization to it. I think some of these indivisible groups that popped up after Trump's election, the sort of resistance movement, as they call themselves, sure. Some of them got wind of this and they were putting out the call to their supporters. I think some of the local Democratic groups were there as well. But I also talked to people who didn't really seem to have any affiliation with, you know, the parties or any of these groups, who were really just upset about Red Tide and maybe heard about it on Facebook or something through some of these, you know, some of these Facebook groups and some of their friends who have been posting about Red Tide.
I'm always interested in the mechanics of how these things come about. And I think it's kind of interesting, certainly with Scott's campaign and some of the other campaigns. A lot of times, first of all, during the campaign, a lot of stuff is genuinely arranged on the fly. So it's not like these guys set their schedules even 2 or 3 days ahead of time. But tell me a little bit about how the press found out about this event and how the protesters might have even found out about this event.
So I never got an email from the campaign, from Rick Scott's campaign, about this event. Usually, you know, you appear in town, you want to get publicity for your candidate, and so you notify the media to come out. I mean, that's sort of half of the reason, or maybe the whole reason, that they appear. Is it's not just to speak to their 50 supporters who are in the restaurant, but it's to speak to everybody in the community through the media. So, you know, to having the media there is sort of essential to these campaign events. And I was never notified. I never got an email about this particular event. I found out about it through other sources and, you know, had to end up emailing the campaign and be like, "Are you guys having an event here? I haven't heard anything from you." And they confirmed it. I think the Republican Party of Sarasota put out an email about this, and that might have been how other folks found out about it. But it didn't come from the campaign. They didn't publicize it. And it's oftentimes they sort of wait to the last minute to publicize some of these things so that people don't get wind of them early and organize protests. But even in this case, they didn't even do it at the last minute. They just didn't publicize it at all, from what I understand.
Wow. And was this event considered part of the Rick Scott bus tour?
Yeah. So this was his 10-day bus tour, which one of the headlines recently called it a bumpy bus tour. It came to an end earlier this week. And it wasn't the only event that had protesters. He had an event up in the Panhandle. I believe it was in Walton County, where there's been a lot of concern about a beach access law that the governor signed that people are worried is going to limit their ability to access the beach. And he was supposed to appear, I think, at a donut shop up there and ended up skipping that event. Some protesters had gathered outside. And then after the event in Venice, he skipped an event down in Naples, which is his hometown. You know, maybe the protests in Venice had rattled him a little bit, but the Naples area is also dealing with red tide. It actually, I think, first started affecting that community, and they've had lots of dead fish that have been rolling up on their beaches as well. So maybe they were concerned that the protest would have erupted at that event as well. I don't know. That's just speculation. But so there's a number of these bus tour events that they ended up either canceling or abbreviating in the case of this Venice event. And he also got there was also a headline where he had actually flown to one of these bus tour events. So there was some question about whether even this he was taking his bus to some of these things, that maybe the bus tour was a misnomer if he was actually flying his campaign plane to some of these events.
And, you know, bad news for not just the environment, but also for the Rick Scott campaign is that there's reports now that the red tide is making its way up toward this area of the Big Bend in Florida, not specifically the Panhandle yet, but along the coast of Northwest Florida. So that's another area that Scott may find himself forced into, you know, further inland, as far away as he can from the coast. I guess the overarching question, though, with all this is how vast is this opposition to Scott, and how angered are people because of this spread of red tide, and who they blame?
Yeah, and do people vote on red tide, or is it bigger other issues that they're most concerned about? It'll be very interesting to see. I mean, if this is something that actually draws people out to the polls, or if it's something that people are upset about, but they don't necessarily, is not necessarily the biggest issue when they go to the ballot box.
Maybe if you own a beachfront home that's getting invaded with red tide, that might sour you on the, I don't know. We'll have to see how that, we'll have to see how that plays out. Now, John Kennedy, you know, sometimes we get accused that we politics writers of just focusing too much on the horse race aspects and who's raising money and all that kind of stuff. Well, John Kennedy is, we're going to have a little wonk fest here, policy wonk fest. John Kennedy's going to walk us through the dueling education proposals by Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis that they both laid out on the same day this week. Tell us a little bit about that and compare and contrast, John.
Well, it's sure. It's basically, you know, very much along partisan lines, I guess, in many respects. You have Democrat Andrew Gillum. He has laid out plans to try to spend an extra $1 billion on schools, and that would be going into public education and also increasing the teacher salaries to where there would be a minimum $50,000 starting salary, which would be a fairly good bump for most starting school teachers around the state. DeSantis came out with his own plan, a Republican, on the same day, talking about he has a $1 billion proposal as well, but his would be built on redirecting school administrative costs into the classroom. He's talking about he has sort of a headline grabber to it, and that's that 80% of state public school dollars would go to the classrooms. That's up from a level of what he says is about 74% right now that went into the classrooms across the state in the 2016-17 school year. So the 80% proposal is part of his package that, you know, he pushes very heavily, very familiar Republican ground, more support for private school vouchers. He wants to expand the state's tax credit scholarship program and give parents more school choice options. And then when it comes to teacher pay, he would primarily be rewarding high-performing teachers. And that's it. No, not much on the across-the-board increases.
John, Gillum has gotten a lot of flack over the corporate tax rate increase, which he wants to use to pay for his education plan and plow $1 billion into education. What do you make of DeSantis in this 80%, spending 80% of the money on classroom and taking money away from administration? I saw the Democrats put out an email and basically said this is not a serious proposal, and that this is kind of thing has been floated in the past, but it doesn't never really pans out. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. It has a certain element of gimmickry to it, I suppose. Gillum, though, too, faces a incredibly uphill fight to get a $1 billion increase in the corporate income tax. He wants to put up the corporate income tax from its current 5.5% rate to 7.75%. And that would help create all this money for schools. However, for that tax to pass, he is going to need approval from 60% of the House and Senate, which is in Republican hands right now and unlikely to change after the November elections. So you could also say maybe Gillum's corporate income tax proposal is equally a gimmick. So I don't know how Floridians are looking at this. Education is always a driver of votes in an election, but both men are promising a little bit on the pie in the sky variety maybe right now.
Yeah, so let me. So I'm clear on DeSantis. What's the overall level of spending on education in Florida, K-12? It's like 20-some billion dollars.
Yeah, it's
right?
About $21 billion goes to schools.
Okay. And so he's saying just by his figures that 74% of that goes to the classroom now, and he's saying by bumping up the classroom portion to 80%, you're effectively shifting $1 billion. That's his estimate.
Evidently, that you could sweat it out of administration somehow, basically.
So I would suspect among voters there isn't probably a whole lot of sympathy for school administrators compared to teachers. But it'll be interesting to see how he sells that. Now, Gillum laid out his thing. You were at a press conference that he did, right? I think DeSantis rolled out his online, but Gillum did his at a press conference. And we have one clip of him, kind of his synopsis of his education policy versus DeSantis. Thomas Cordy is going to play that clip for us right now.
You have Ron DeSantis, former member of Congress, and Donald Trump, who wish to take Florida's families and Florida children back. And you've got our campaign, which is intensely focused on moving Florida's families and Florida kids forward.
We've talked a lot in past podcasts about the way this race has been very nationalized, and the candidates, Gillum in particular, have brought a lot of issues into the race that aren't really related to state government necessarily. And I think I just thought it was interesting in selling his education plan, he brings Donald Trump into the mix. Tell us a little more about that, John.
Well, Gillum has been very much of a nationally watched candidate right now. His upset victory in the Democratic primary has drawn a lot of attention to him. And a lot of what he is running against is a little bit of a portrayal that Florida is a state divided between haves and have-nots. He raises this idea of increasing taxes on corporations as being something that that they should be just paying their fair share, just as many Floridians are struggling to make ends meet. So it's a remarkable message that he is sending out there. Of course, the Republicans, by contrast, are vilifying Gillum for this this idea of raising taxes. It is a remarkable move by a candidate to run on the idea of boosting taxes. But Gillum's people keep saying that this is only going to affect a very small number of Florida corporations, and that this is a worthwhile investment. So, however, though, the business groups are already, sharpening their attacks against Gillum, and the Republican Governors Association, or I'm sorry, the Republican National Committee, just earlier this week, ran a TV spot talking about Gillum, how we cannot afford Andrew Gillum and his policies.
It's noteworthy that it's not just Republicans that are concerned about this or leery of raising taxes. I talked to five different Democratic candidates who are running for the state legislature in this area last week, and not a single one of them said unequivocally that they would support Gillum's proposal, that only one of them said that she thought, you know, raising the corporate tax rate, at least to some degree, was probably a good idea. And three of them just said outright that they either opposed it or had really strong reservations about it. So I think even Democrats are concerned, especially Democrats who are running in maybe swing seats or GOP leaning seats, about being on record supporting this tax increase.
We've also seen that as well with Bill Nelson, who is, you know, sharing a statewide ticket with Gillum. He too has distanced himself from a lot of Gillum's proposals, which involve such things as abolishing ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, expanding Medicaid is something that Nelson does go along with. But there's some real contrast between the two leading Democratic candidates statewide right now as well.
Yeah, it'll definitely be interesting to see how other Democrats play that tax increase issue, which is a pretty prominent part of Gillum's campaign. And I guess, you know, the selling job for Democrats or for Gillum is that, yeah, it's a $1 billion tax increase, but it's, you know, he's casting it as making corporations pay their fair share and arguing that it won't affect ordinary people. And, you know, we'll see how that plays out. I wanted to talk real briefly before we finish up about polls. We've mentioned here before, especially in the Democratic primary, not a single poll had Andrew Gillum in the lead. Some polls even, you know, a week or two before had him in third or fourth place. And now many of those same pollsters are cranking out polls for the general election. Just brief thoughts from each of you on how should consumers of political news look at these polls, because we're going to be definitely seeing a lot of them over the next 2 months.
I think we're all a little skeptical. You know, we've been burned, so we're hesitant to put too much into these. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the polls during the presidential race, you know, were pretty accurate in terms of, you know, having a close race between Trump and Clinton here in Florida. You know, these are just one data point, each of these polls. You know, it's probably better to look at them in aggregation and see if what the trend is. For example, Gillum has been leading DeSantis in a lot of these polls. I mean, you'd have to have all these pollsters be way off if that was wrong. So it's interesting to see what the trends are to me, and to see if, you know, all these polls tend to point in the same direction, or if there's a lot of variability in them.
I think we as a media also have to be very careful in how we report them, because indeed, when it comes to things like margin of error in a poll, that means just about every number in that poll can be up or down by margin of error, maybe 3%. So when we see, as Zach points out, if you look in the aggregation and you have one guy ahead by 3%, well, in the aggregate of all those polls, that 3% can disappear just in margin of error. So, you know, when you have polls that show races like we have in Florida right now, the big statewide races, Gillum versus DeSantis for governor, and then Scott versus Nelson for U.S. Senate, both of those are pretty much within the margin of error when it comes to the results. So, you know, it's kind of hard to say, you know, who's going to win by a field goal here at the you know, when it comes to the final play of the game.
The aggregations, I would note, would have told us, though, that Gwen Graham would be the Democratic nominee. Now, there is it is true, though, that general election polls tend to be a little more accurate than primary polls, especially a primary. I mean, a primary is a very low turnout enterprise, and especially with five candidates like there were in this Democratic primary. There's a lot of things that can go wrong, and they clearly did in the polling before this primary. Generally speaking, a general election, the turnout, the people that are going to turn out is a little more predictable. It's a larger universe, and you know, usually the general election polls are a little more on point than primary polling. But it is definitely worth having some healthy skepticism going forward, although I'm sure we'll talk a lot about polls between now and then. But speaking of numbers, I hear some music playing. We're going to return now to the pick a number segment. And we're going to explain those numbers that we put forward earlier. And so you note takers will know. Let's go highest to lowest this time. John Kennedy had that great big 378. What is that number, John?
Yeah, George, that's the number of companies in Florida who reported more than $10 million in profits, and they paid 57% of the amount of revenue the state takes in from the corporate income tax. That brings in about $2.2 billion, according to Department of Revenue data that was obtained by Florida Tax Watch, the business-backed research organization. This gets to the point of Gillum talking about who's going to be paying this corporate income tax increase that he wants. He's been saying all along that only about 3% of Florida companies will pay his proposed increase. I can't immediately vouch for that 3% figure, but it is a relatively small number of companies that are coughing up corporate income tax in Florida.
So it sounds like a pretty narrow base. So 378 companies are paying more than half of the corporate income tax. Is that right?
That's right. They're the big ones right now.
Okay. So I guess you can interpret that a lot of ways. I mean, for one thing, I guess if a couple of those get hacked off and decide to leave, that you're taking a bunch of money with you. I don't know. There's different ways you can look at that. That's an interesting number, though. Okay, so next, the next lowest number was my number, 32.2. That's the number, percentage of voters who blame state government for the algae problem in Florida. FAU asked, who's responsible for the algae problem? And it's been a big issue in the Senate race between Scott and Nelson because Rick Scott has said the federal government is to blame for delaying Everglades restoration for years. And Nelson and the Democrats have said it's state government's fault because Rick Scott has cut back on environmental regulations. So who's to blame is an important question. 32.2% of respondents in this FAU poll blame state government. Only 13.3% blame the federal government. Another 17% blamed local governments. And then close to 38% said they don't know. And that last number, so actually a plurality of people don't have an opinion yet, which is a huge opening for political consultants and TV ad makers to do some persuasion work. So I would expect we'll see some more ads in the coming weeks, each side blaming the other for the algae problem. So that was my number. Now, Zach Anderson, your number was 18. Explain that one to us, please.
George, I also went with a poll number. One of the polls that came out yesterday was from a Reuters Ipsos University of Virginia Center of Politics poll. And I got a hold of that poll and looked at some of the cross tabs. And one of the questions that they asked, I thought was pretty interesting. It said, if the election for U.S. Congress were held today, would you vote for the Democratic candidate or the Republican candidate in the district where you live? And 47% said the Democratic candidate, 44% said the Republican candidate. And it was pretty, the numbers were as you would expect, 94% of Democrats would choose a Democratic candidate, 91% of Republicans would choose the Republican candidate. But the reason I picked 18, which I thought was interesting, was that the only 18% of likely independent voters would choose the Republican candidate, only 18%, whereas 42% of independent voters said they would choose the Democratic candidate here in Florida. So, you know, obviously independents are huge. They're a growing segment of the Florida voting populace, and they're very important. Barack Obama won independence in Florida two times when he was elected president, and he won this state. And Donald Trump won independence in Florida when he won this state in 2016. The candidate that wins independence tends to do well. And so the fact that only 18% of independents say they plan to vote for the Republican candidate for Congress is a warning sign for those candidates.
Red flag. Okay, those are some strong numbers there. And that brings us to the conclusion of another Inside Florida Politics podcast. Once again, I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, joining you from West Palm Beach. I've been assisted today in the studio by Thomas Cordy, our sound engineer. And we've also had from Tallahassee, State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy, and Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson. Thank you.